Okay, now it's recording.
Are you going to listen to them?
I'm sorry?
Are you going to listen to them?
I will listen to this later. Well, I might put it online because that's what I do. So if you are listening online, this is Stephen Downs, and I'm sitting in Alejandro. I can't pronounce your last name. I always want to say Piscitelli, but I know that's wrong.
Piscitelli.
Well, that's close. In his backyard in Tigre, in Argentina, and it is May Day, the 1st of May, 2010, and I am surrounded by a wonderful group of people who are sharing a cup of mate. I don't know if you call it a cup of mate or...
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll just put that there, and I hope it works out. And what do you want me to talk about?
What are the principal apart from the connectivism to Vygotsky theory?
Oh boy.
The light one.
Yeah.
The first question is that the light one.
Yeah. First of all, let me be clear that I'm not an expert in Vygotsky. And although people in the field of education draw a lot of their influence from him, my background is different. And so there's no history of studying Vygotsky in my work. So I need to be careful about that right from the very beginning. I just come from a different worldview. That said, there's the idea in constructivism. Gracias. I've just received cake. You see, people listening on audio, you have to tell them what's happening. It's like radio, you know. So. Just like radio. That's another career I would have had if I didn't have the career I had. Radio. I was always interested in radio. I think I would have been good at it. There's this... See, and so my answer is not really going to have anything to do with what Vygotsky says, but my sort of skewed version of what Vygotsky says. There's this idea of making meaning, of constructing knowledge, that I think is misconstrued. And there's this idea of sociology that I think is misconstrued. And it's something that's... I sometimes criticize George Siemens because I don't think he's clear about this. I think learning is inherently and intrinsically personal, not social. And it does not mean that there is no social learning. Obviously, there is social learning. The evidence of that is right in front of us. We're in a group, right? So there is social learning. But the learning itself isn't social. Each one of us sitting around here, around this table, has our own unique perspective, our own unique point of view, our own unique history, and our own unique understanding of what results from that learning, what results from that experience. And, you know, if we come back a week from now and ask what I said here today, you'd get, well, how many people are there here? 10? You get 20 different answers because everybody would have their own interpretation, their own view of what happened. And this understanding, this view, is not something that we create intentionally. It's not something that we construct. It's not something that we organize and characterize. It's something that is a lot more natural, something that we do naturally. It's an assimilation of an experience rather than a theorizing of an experience. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
It's yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. One roll of the eyes, that's fair. I am much more rooted in neurological theories of learning, my understanding of how people learn is based on my understanding of the structure of the brain and how the brain as a network forms networks of connections. And so I'll draw a parallel between the way a society learns and the way an individual learns, because both of those are networks, so both of those learn in the same way. But I draw, you know, especially I had a paper, An Introduction to Connective Knowledge, I draw a very clear distinction, where I think the constructivists do not, between what is learned by a society and what is learned by a person. And I think they are two different things. And I think that the knowledge of the society intrinsically cannot become the knowledge of the person. It can influence or induce knowledge in the person, but it isn't the same. And it's important to understand that. So when a social group creates knowledge through interaction, through networking, through exchange, through conversation, that knowledge is not what the members of the group learn. Each member of the group learns his or own, her own version that may or may not reflect that social knowledge, but is not directly isomorphic to it, is not directly tied to it. So I stress much more, I think, than constructivists, and especially social constructivists, the role of the individual learning in learning and the idea of personal learning and what people do personally in order to learn. And so I see them as learning, yes, from social groups, yes, from experience and interaction, but from immersion in an environment generally. Any environment for a person is a learning environment, whether or not there is social learning taking place. How was that? So the constructivist can come back with a refutation one day and say, you've completely misunderstood our theory. And that's fine.
Maybe I ask, what are the problems you usually find? I don't know, maybe if you're today working with students or student groups, what are the problems do you find when you try to practice that point of view?
Well, yeah, maybe that's another difference between me and constructivists. For me, practice. Well, it's a good question, because it gets at the heart of what is it to teach, right? The question is, you know, sort of like, what are the problems you have with students? I'm paraphrasing it a bit. But that presumes, in the question, it presumes almost some sort of power relationship with students, where I'm a person that would be in a position to have a problem with students, mm-hmm. right? Which, from my perspective, is almost senseless. It'd be like asking, well, what are the problems I have with the people sitting around me at the table? That doesn't make sense, you know. They're all individuals and people, and I might like you or not like you, but I mean, it's not an educational question. My approach to learning and my approach to teaching isn't one where the teacher teaches, the learner learns. I've never believed in that, because I don't believe that you can take content from a teacher's mind and put it into a student's mind, because there's no direct communication. We don't have mental telepathy, and even if we did, we'd still have to deal with skepticism. Can we rely on telepathy? You know, how do you know? If I have a mental image of your brain, is it really the mental image that you're having? Or, you know, it's like, if I perceive that you are perceiving green, am I perceiving your perception of green in the same way that you are perceiving green?
Thank you.
So you get into horrible problems with that. So no matter how we depict it, my knowledge has to go through a process of translation, a process of media change, you know, from a neural structure to a syntactic structure and back into a neural structure, and in that, you know, essential elements of the knowledge are lost. So you can't just transfer content. It doesn't work that way. The best I can do if I'm in a teaching role is to, I used the word recently, induce. Induce you to have ideas. You know, get you thinking in a certain way. But of course, you are the one who has to do that sort of thinking. But now, what does that, what sort of role does that give me as a teacher? Well, it's not a role where I taught. Well, and you might say, well, this is ridiculous. Look, right now, you're talking. Right? Here you are, busy communicating to other people. But the important things that I'm communicating aren't the words that I'm communicating. It's an approach, it's a way of thinking, it's a way of engaging. There are many more important things about the communication that I'm undertaking right now than the words. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think when you all go away and you reflect on that, you'll realize you remembered not the words that I said, but the way that I said them, the expression that I had, was I willing to talk, was I willing to share, all of that sort of thing. And yeah, maybe the words will play a role. I mean, it's not like words are meaningless. That would be a silly position to take. But, you know, I will not have been successful in taking my understanding and putting it in your brain. Not possibly successful. It's not possible. So for me, to teach is not to transmit. I've said elsewhere that to teach is to model and to demonstrate. And so, you know, if you ask about the relation between me and quote unquote my students, the role that I play is just to do whatever it is that I do. And what it is that I do is I'm a philosopher, I'm a technologist, I'm a researcher, I'm a computer programmer, I'm a writer. Those are the things that I do. But what I do is I do them openly. I do them, but I also reflect on what I'm doing as I'm doing them, and then I share that reflection. And then those who learn from me are those who are interested in what I do. Might be one person, might be 10 people, might be 100 people, doesn't matter, right? There isn't a sense in my teaching where I have a class of students in front of me who are required to learn a certain body of content. You know, and you ask the question.
You do or you don't? You said you have.
No, there is not the sense.
There's not.
Yeah, there is not the sense that I have a class, you know, a certain set of people that has to learn a certain set of content. I've taught courses with George Siemens over the last couple of years. I'm doing another one with Rita Kopp in September, and you know, and I've been doing this sort of thing off and on over the years. And basically what we will do, what George and I did, and what Rita and I will do, is we will work through a series of content. And we'll start off with, you know, maybe an outline of what we want to work through, but you know, we don't have some sort of body of material we want people to learn. We're simply going to go through this material ourselves and think about this material, write about this material, organize this material, because organizing is creative, and let people watch. And we'll invite them to participate in our discussion by creating their own material, doing their own things. And so, if there's a student who is a quote-unquote problem, generally what happens is they go away and everyone's happy. So, I'm pausing because now I'm thinking back to the first course where there was a student who was a problem who didn't go away. but it's still okay because, I mean, you know, in traditional learning, everything's in a classroom. If you have a disruptive student, the whole class is disrupted, right? And the way we set up the connectivism course at first, the first few weeks, everybody focused on the Moodle, and on the Moodle classroom, the person was disruptive and everyone was disrupted.
Mm-hmm.
But the model that we were building toward was to distribute the course so everybody wrote in their own place. People wrote in their own blogs, and in fact, 170 different people wrote blogs in that course. And so the content was distributed. So when this person was disrupted, it didn't matter. Disruptive, it didn't matter, right? They did not disrupt the rest of the course. The rest of the course could just ignore her.
Mm.
So, again, you know, it's not like we need to control this person. It's not like we need to have establish a power relationship over this person. The people, individuals, negotiate their own communications. And actually, and I find this very interesting, I found this person really disruptive because she came into the course bound and determined to prove that George and I were techno-communists and therefore evil. Techno-communists. Which is pretty interesting, and especially interesting for me, although I have a long history of being a socialist. But I'm not really a communist. I'm a very good socialist, but I'm a very bad communist. And even, actually, the socialists think I'm a very bad socialist, too. So, because I'm not really into collectivism. I'm into cooperativism. There's a distinction there. So, I found this person very disruptive. Other people in the course thought this person was the greatest thing that walked on earth, and that she brought a valuable perspective to the classroom, and they enjoyed engaging her in dialogue. And from my perspective, fine. You guys have your conversation. I'll have my conversation. George will have his conversation. The people in Second Life will have their conversation. The network can be more or less connected in certain places, and everything's cool. And that's exactly how it worked out. And then she got bored and left because she couldn't disrupt the entire class. It was not possible. So, you know, I don't have in this approach, in a certain sense, it's not possible to have problems with students, you know, in the way that you would describe. I'm just thinking, you know, a lot of people when they ask a question like that, tell me if I'm going on too long. You know, you ask a short question, you get like an hour answer. I don't need to babble, but people talked about things like motivation, you know, and even I was in the lecture in Cordoba, panel discussion in Cordoba a couple of days ago. And it was mostly students who were in attendance, and well, they were behaving like students. So, you know, you look out at the crowd, and there's a couple of girls and guys flirting. There's people coming, people going, people taking pictures, people texting, people having conversations. So, yeah, there is that. But, you know, it's an attitude kind of thing. What I really liked about an event like that, which is different from the classroom, and I said this to a group of people in England at an Alt-C conference in Manchester, the reason why our session works so well is that if you don't like it, you can leave. And that's a big difference between that and your traditional classroom where you're required to attend. You know, now, what do you do when the person is required to attend? They can't leave. You can't get rid of them. And if they're bored, they'll let you know. You know, and especially when they didn't want to be there in the first place. That's where you get these problems from. You know, here, look at this group, right? No problems with this group at all, except for this guy who keeps rolling his eyes. Sorry, I'm just kidding.
Talking about you, right?
Yeah, he was busy texting. You know, you're here because you want to be. Well, except him. and it makes all the difference in the world. And if you didn't want to be here, you wouldn't be here. And it wouldn't matter. Nobody would be insulted. I wouldn't be insulted. Alejandro wouldn't be insulted. You wouldn't be insulted, right?
No.
No? Super. So, yeah, actually, he said to me earlier, you know, if you want to leave, you can. So, I tried not to take that as a hint. Just kidding. So, you know, I really think, you know, questions of motivation, questions of conduct, of behavior, are very much questions of power and control, in the sense that the more you try to exert power and control, the more you are going to have problems of behavior and conduct. But where, you know, students are responsible for their own learning, where they're making choices about their own learning, then you are much less likely to have these problems, almost by definition, right? And you know, just to wrap up, people say, well, people who make their own choices about learning will always make the wrong choices. And I'd like to see the evidence of that. You know, the system of learning, at least in my country, in the United States and elsewhere, and I understand probably here, you know, we teach children from a young age that we know what's good for them to learn and they don't, and they have to do what we say. You know, it's like described by John Holt. It's like described by that letters from the school children of Babriano. I forget the exact name. You know, where they learn how to do what they're told. You know, they learn that what learning is doing what you're told. They learn that what learning is following instructions and planning to be successful on the test, satisfying the teacher, reading the teacher, right? Playing the teacher, you know, gaming the teacher. And that's what learning becomes. Again, you know, it's this whole question of what do, you know, they don't actually learn the content. They learn the system of learning. And, you know, I want to see the evidence that says, if instead of teaching children from a young age how to take instruction, we taught students how to create their own learning, where is the argument that this would not be successful? I don't think there is such an argument. I know there's no evidence, and certainly everything that I've seen suggests that, you know, when they are given this opportunity, that they do take advantage of it. What's his name? The guy, the hole in the wall. Savatamitra. Took a computer, stuck it in a hole in a wall in India, a little glass front on it, so nobody would steal it, and then just left it. Didn't try to teach the students how to use the computer at all. And these are kids that don't have formal schooling, quite the opposite. They taught themselves how to use the computer. And it's an experiment that's replicated over and over and over again. So, you know, the evidence that I see is that if you give students the opportunity to choose their own direction, to follow their own interests, they will learn, and they will learn actually more quickly and without disruption. So that doesn't mean setting them free with dynamite and cars and airplanes. And,
that'd be interesting.
You know, you don't let them run free through hospitals. You know, they are children. You know, and they're by definition not responsible for their behavior. So, I mean, you have to take measures to prevent them from injuring themselves and you know, disrupting society, but minimal measures and measures intended for safety rather than control. I hope that wasn't too long.
Stephen, what about how to? I mean, when you are telling these things, you know, I think I'm knowing the problems that we got when we try to construct that approach.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things is how to manage those different groups, and you are a small team and you have 170 students, so
yeah,
maybe 200 like that our course now. So how you can give them the best, I mean the best in advice, in coaching, and that's really difficult. We have to
sure.
split in ourselves to try to focus on those different groups, and that's I think it's hard to manage.
Well, I mean you're in a situation that's broken to begin with, right?
Yeah.
You know, so it's sort of like, you know, how do you serve dinner when the ship is sinking? Well, there are going to be problems with the table service. There's no way around that. So sometimes these analogies work, sometimes they don't. So there's not going to be an easy fix to a problem like you described. I don't know if there's going to be any fix to the problem you described. Because, you know, the sort of model that I would envision being more successful in the long run is not a model where we take children, group them into a group of 150 children, and then try to set some adults to manage this process.
Please, how old are your students, on average?
How old? No, I'm not a school teacher.
No, but when you talk about...
At the university level,
about
the 170 people you had on your course.
Oh, okay, yeah. The
20s?
No, they're going to be mostly adults.
Adults.
Yeah. The people that I've
over
taught...
25, you call
it. Oh, no, I've had... Yeah, I mean, I've taught different age groups at different times, but the youngest would be 18 years old, like just out of high school, first year university, first year college.
But they take those courses outside the university, or
well,
as part of the...
Well, I've taught for many years, right? So when I was teaching in university, it was right in class, right? Same when I taught at college, it was all in class. I've taught evening classes to adults. I've taught by distance using the telephone. I've taught by distance using the computer. I've taught teachers. I've done seminars and lectures. The stuff that I've done online recently with George is the most recent thing that I've done. You know, I've done dozens and dozens of classes with online conferencing tools. So, but yeah, my actual experience in teaching has been generally ages 18 and up. So. Was there a follow-up, or did you just want to know?
No, that's because we are on our average is on our 20s.
Okay.
20 to 22, so it's maybe similar.
Similar, yeah.
But the point is still
oh,
that
I
we
see.
Have different groups, so we have
yeah.
to organize
right.
teaching at different levels. So
I understand.
That's really
yeah.
what is
And to follow the conversation.
Yeah.
yeah.
But
because, you know, you are talking about motivation and
mm-hmm.
The first level may be motivated, but it's not sure that they are equally motivated. So when this motivation has spillover. It's not sure that it works. And we have 40 weeks. We don't have a year, 1 year, or 6 months.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, that's why I say it's a system that's broken.
Yes.
Right. So, let's begin with that proposition. That system is broken.
Yes. It's
okay. And that's important to understand, because what I'm talking about is not a way to fix that system.
Yeah.
That system can't be fixed.
We said it the first class. You were not there, but in the first theoretical,
yeah.
we said it. We don't want to change university. remember?
Mm-hmm.
I said it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's really important to always come back to that point, and especially when talking to teachers, because, you know, it's almost every time I give a talk, they'll say, well, yeah, all that's very fine. How can I apply it in my class? And I go, I don't say it, but I want to say, you know, the tips and tricks lecture is down the hall, you know. There's always someone who's going to have tips and tricks. That's not what I deliver. So let's take the scenario. Let's take the scenario anyways, because that's reality. You have, I don't know, 170 students, a teacher, two teachers, whatever. Now, the advice is going to be different depending on who you're talking to. To the students. So, I'm talking to these students who are stuck in this class. And I say stuck in this class because they probably have to be there, right? And so my first response is, okay, I know you have to be here. I'm really sorry. I would fix that if I could. And, you know, the best you can do is to try to use the time that you're here gainfully. And if the class material isn't useful to you, then do something else during that time. Now, so right off, you get the culture clash between the way I would approach this and the way the teachers who approach this, who say, look, I don't want any laptops, I don't want any cell phones, I don't want you doing anything else other than following this class. And I think that's exactly the wrong approach. If my lecture is not interesting to you, do something else. I mean, duh. And I've always taught that way. I was that way as a student. I remember, and maybe I shouldn't say this in a thing that's being recorded, but I'll say it anyways. In my final year of my BA in philosophy, I decided I needed to get serious because I had student loans. I had big student loans. And when I graduated, I was going to have to pay those back. And the only way to avoid paying those back was to go to grad school. And the only way to go to grad school was to get a perfect grade point average. So I had to be serious. So this is in the fifth year of my four-year degree, because I spent so much time working on the student newspaper. I'm going to be serious. I got to make it to all of my lectures this year. So I put a chart on the wall, and every time I made it to my class, put a little X. I made it to two-thirds of my classes that year. Best year ever by a wide margin. So that's the first rule. Don't waste your time with classes if it's not helping. And if they take attendance, if they have participation grades or whatever, okay, show up, but make sure you bring some other work, you know, and use the, because it's your time. It's not their time, it's your time. And there's an undercurrent to that. And the undercurrent, undercurrent, that's not the right word, a sub-theme to that sort of message, and the sub-theme is
underlying
theme, you are the one who is responsible for your own education. If you depend on your teacher for your education, you are lost. That will not work. You will be set adrift. And being responsible for your own education, well, it means a whole bunch of things most of the time students don't really learn these things. It means being responsible for your own records, scheduling your time, balancing your different classes, because every teacher will say their class is the most important. They're lying. It's not, probably. There may be one class that is most important, but that's up to you to decide which it is. You know, there's a whole range of things. And then More than that, if you believe your education is only what you're taking in the class, you're lost, right? You know, especially at this time of life, you know, and if we're talking about especially 18 to 25 year olds, it's a very influential time of life. You know, you need to be exposing yourself to a wide range of interests. And this is the time, maybe between 16 and 25, this is the time to find these interests and to pursue them, no matter what you're doing in class. So that should be what really occupies your priorities. In my case, it was the student newspaper. And then later on, it was my work in philosophy and in media of different sorts. This is the thing that got me going, you know, and that was an interest of mine from a young age. You know, I was in grade 5, 13 years old. I had my own newspaper. It was called the Eagle Report. When the arena burnt down in Metcalf, where I lived, I drew a picture of the arena burning. That was a very bad picture. I tried to sell my Eagle Report for 5 cents a copy. I think I sold like 3 copies. I kept producing that thing for years because that's what I was interested in. So when I was at university, that was equally important in my classes. It was not till the last year that I decided to get serious about my classes, and even then, I was equally serious about the newspaper. So the advice to the students is, you know, like, take control of your own learning, learn beyond the classroom, follow your own interests. There are things you have to do, and, you know, that maybe that's a life lesson. There are always going to be things you have to do. You also have to go to the dentist. You also have to, I don't know, well, you can think of the things you have to do. They're unpleasant and they're not productive, but you have to do them. Well, actually, the dentist is more productive than a lot of things, but you know what I mean. You know, there's, you know, when you work, well, now I have a job, I have to fill in reports, so many reports, to account for my time. I have to do some commercial work, I have to do some writing, you know. These are things you have to do that are not necessarily things that you want to do. But even in work, you take your job and you transform your job into what your career is going to be. You know, it's the same lesson. And this is the lesson that's important to tell to students. And so, you know, in the scenario, one person, 170 people, day one, week one, day one, my approach as an instructor always has been, look, I don't own your learning. You own your learning. And you're going to have to decide how to do that. I can't do that. And, you know, there's no way around that. I can't force you to learn. And I have no intention, no desire to try, because my life is too short and so is yours. That's the one thing. Now, to the teachers, I say the same thing. Now when I'm talking to teachers, I don't talk to teachers about how to teach students. I'm actually not interested in that. When I talk to teachers, I talk to teachers about how to learn, how they should conduct their own learning, how they should advance their own interests, follow their own career path, pursue their own learning in their own way. I talk to them about ways of connecting with other teachers, perhaps, if that's what they're interested in. If they're interested in a different subject, how to talk to other people, connect with other people. I talk about how they can make their own learning relevant to themselves, how they can find ways of learning, even though they're busy working all day as a teacher. There's still ways of finding learning in the community around you. I talk about working openly so that they can help other people learn from them simply by watching them do their job in an open way, and forming this learning community themselves. I'm not at all interested in telling teachers how to teach, because every teacher, in my view, is going to have his or her different style anyways. I know I certainly have my style, and my style, as you've already seen, is to babble a lot. But, it wouldn't make sense, and it's not reasonable to suppose that what works for me is going to work for you. It comes back to the whole question of theory, right, that we were talking about earlier. Is there an underlying theory of education? Probably not. There are different, there are, sorry for those of you who spent the last 4 years learning that there is. how could there be, right? Each of us has our own experience, our own background, our own aptitudes, interests, capacities. There are people out there who will say there's no such thing as learning styles, and maybe, in this world of universal theories and tests and predictions and things like that, there's no such thing as learning styles. But look around, none of us is dressed the same as the other. None of us is sitting in the same posture as any of the others. This is associating non-linguistic things, right? Nobody has a meaning in the shirt that they're wearing or anything, except I chose this one because I didn't like any of them. But you know what I mean? There's no meaning. Oh, yeah, there are people at the garage trying to get in.
Come, acá, Alejandro, acá, Alejandro, acá.
Usually people, when I start talking, are trying to get out.
You're like here.
Yeah.
Well, so, miracles happen.
So, and
hola.
Hola.
Can I try the mate?
Yes. Are you sure?
Oh yeah, I'm not afraid.
We thought we could run out of questions, so
we brought more. Hi.
Brigade.
More questions.
Fresh questions.
Fresh questions. Fresh questions.
A break for you.
It's
a break. Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good enough. Strong enough.
I don't know what strong enough
yes,
is.
Yes, that's why. That's what I
mean.
No.
Ah, no.
Pásame mi bolso, ese bolso de Pernambuco.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. It's similar to green tea.
Yeah, exactly. Very similar. Is there any caffeine in it? I guess there's no caffeine, is there?
I don't know.
It'd be a lot better if there was caffeine in it.
Yes, mate, which is similar.
Okay, so it's not just...
It keeps you awake.
Oh, it does. Okay.
Yeah.
So, well, okay, all the factors are in Spanish. A fibra elementaria.
It's
all the different things.
Yeah, it doesn't say.
Yeah.
It says the leaf.
Yeah.
Something similar to caffeine.
Okay. Good enough.
No, ahora me vuelvo a mi lugar.
I read about it before I came here, so I was curious.
No, me tomé.
So, more?
No, let's challenge being living in peace or with tension our work as teachers, philosophers, researchers, etc. How do you feel? Because I feel very much in tension in the last 2-3 years as we've been making all those innovations, really, things were somehow, you know, moving. So it's nice. I'm not complaining about it. But
yeah.
It's tension. It's attention and
sure.
And accept living attention and not knowing about results and accepting that the results are not going to be what we want them to
yeah.
be. It's a challenge.
It's very much a challenge. I agree. It's funny. There's key points in a career, right? Probably the key point in my teaching career was when I learned to be able to say, I don't know.
Yeah.
Now I use it all the time. And of course, anyone who acquires any expertise in any discipline will say this to you. Nobody can know everything. It's simply not possible. There is utterly no shame in not knowing even obvious things. And there's stuff that, you know, I discover that everybody else knew, and I discovered, oh my, you know. But that's life. You know, that's the way it works. So that was a key moment. And so being able to accept that, of course, then what I did is I turned it into an epistemology, right? You know, you can't know everything, but we all as a society do know everything. Therefore, the knowledge of the society must be different from the knowledge of the individual. Of course. So that turns out to be important. Another key thing that I learned, and I had to grow well into adulthood to learn this, was how to say thank you. It's an odd thing. Well, how hard is it to say thank you? But, a lot of people are not sure of their own capacity. Especially people who have a more of an intellectualist slant, especially people who study knowledge and learning and related subjects, because they see, you know, the scope of the world's knowledge and the scale of the achievement of people like Descartes and Kant and others, and they say, well, how can I measure up at all? And, you know, and because of that, there's always the possibility that what they're doing is wrong or inadequate, insufficient, and it's hard to be confident in one's own work. And when you're not confident in your own work, and people say good things about it, you question them, right? Why are they saying you did a good job? You know, maybe they're just flattering me. Maybe they want something from me, because really, you know, compared to Descartes, my work is crap. But when you get to the point that you can accept that your work actually is good enough, then you're able to say, oh, gracias. Then you're able to say, thank you. That really is good.
Do you feel the difference?
Pardon?
Do you feel the difference?
This is a new one.
Oh, okay.
It's a new one.
Yeah, it is stronger.
We
yeah.
obtained.
Yeah.
The best thing
like
about okay. is the sharing
part. Yeah. Yeah. That's what I read. Yeah, I read there's one. It's a shared experience. I also read instructions like don't stir the.
Yeah. And don't say thank you. No, oh, and if you say thank you, it means you don't want it anymore.
Oh,
you
oh,
say
I
thank
see.
You at the end when you are
yeah.
when
my,
you have
your last one.
You
know.
See, that was not in the book.
No.
So I'll
when
just pass it on.
Yeah. That.
Yes. Well, that's That's part of learning, is immersing. Yes. You know, there's a difference between learning by immersing in an environment and learning by studying in a book, and we're seeing a practical example of that. I've forgotten the question. Oh, how do you deal with conflict?
Yeah.
Yeah. The now the other thing too. It's really important to stay grounded. You know, and not to be swept up by these changes. So they're different. There's some different things here that, again, this is my own experience that I can share, and the only thing that I can share. But one thing I do, because I work in a world of change, constant. You know, next week's going to be different from last week. I know it for sure. So I try to have things that stay the same. You know, I cling to my routines. You know, simple things. I get up at the same time every day. I go to sleep at the same time every day. I have a routine where, you know, before I go to sleep, I read some pages out of my book and listen to the baseball game on the radio. Or if it's the winter and there's no baseball game, I listen to some music on my iPod. You know, I make sure that I go out. You know, I go out into the country or to parks or things like that. I work with my hands on things that are concrete. If you look at my pictures in Flickr, you see where I go out into the woods, but you also see I've done plastering on the inside of my house. You know, it's easy to make the mistake of thinking that plastering your house is not worth your time, that there are more important things to do. But what plastering your house does, and another simple task, gardening is another one, you know, these are the things that keep you grounded. These are the things that keep you connected to the world. These are the things that don't change. The earth is always going to be the earth. Plaster is always going to be plaster. You know, cracks in your wall are always going to be cracks in your wall. You know, so these are things that remind you that things can stay the same. But by the same token, you know, it's the lesson of Buddhism is not to cling to these things. That, you know, to recognize that things do change. You may lose your garden. It may hail. The neighbor's tree, a beautiful tree, was split in half in a snowstorm. And she spent so much time tending to her tree, and then it was gone. And that's, you know, that's life. It changes. Like, there's, you know, it's not always cycles. Sometimes it begins, sometimes it ends. Learning to accept that and to go with it. Douglas Rushkoff talks about, you know, it's to treat this environment not as something to be captured and stored, but rather to be ridden like a wave. And he says, you know, it's no coincidence that the metaphor of the internet is the metaphor of surfing. Surfing, whether on the water, surfing on a skateboard, or surfing on a snowboard, it's all the same. It's, you know, you don't try to acquire the environment. You don't try to understand the environment and comprehend the environment. You try to work with the environment and go the way the environment goes. And then the final thing is the lesson from Taoism, and that's balance and harmony. And, you know, if people ask what I seek in my life, it's this balance and harmony, right? And it's important to stay balanced. You know, athletes will say, and you know, you have footballers here, and I'll bet you they do say this here. They certainly say it in Canada. You know, you don't let the highs get too high. You don't let the lows get too low. Because when you're in sports, you're going to have a lot of both. You know, unless you're not very good, in which case you'll have a lot of lows, in which case you really don't want to be too low. But, you know, it's great to win, but it can't be everything. And it is bad to lose, but it can't be everything. So, you know, living in that way, not trying to acquire, not trying to hoard, not trying to come to some sort of fixed and permanent sense of the world, you know, not trying to cling, that really is the only way to operate in a dynamic, rapidly changing environment. And that's what I do anyways. And mostly it works, and I've learned to live with the failures. I hope that's a good answer. Well, if it was a bad answer, it was the best I could do.
Not good as the card, but good.
Not as good as the card. That's funny. That's great.
Well, I suppose, you know, we are sort of celebrating our first results with this book from, you know, the redesign program that changed a lot from last year. So it was mainly Facebook.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
So for us it was also, it is still a challenge because we don't know which the results are going to be, and we have to be comfortable about it.
Yeah.
And we have to accept it as part of the game.
Yeah.
If we recognize the system is broken,
yeah,
and if we acknowledge that we don't want to change the system, we're not going to repair the university,
right,
you know, we're just going to do something different,
yeah,
that you've been doing until now. So we have to accept our results as they come,
yeah,
and be able to accept and just move forward. And maybe next term we'll have a couple of things to do differently, but still we have to accept. And I think, you know, a week ago we were very tense.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you know, it's going to be, I think it's part of the game.
It's, yeah, you know, and it's pretty easy to get invested in an outcome. And it's natural to do that, especially, you know, if, you know, grant money depends on it. But, yeah, you can't. It's like the unconference, right? The rule of the unconference is the people who are here are the right people.
Yeah.
The birds flying overhead are the right birds. I don't even know what those are, but they're pretty cool. Does anyone, what are those?
I don't know what they mean in Spanish.
Dedos.
Okay.
Now I'm seeing
dedos.
Yeah.
It
is this kind of bird that they are like very protective of the area.
Oh, okay.
And if you dare to walk into their area, they are going to start. I don't know if you have
an idea. No. I've never seen them before. That's why I was asking.
Dedo?
Oh, you have my little Spanish book.
También se dice, ¿cuál es el cuento? ¿Cómo se dice de Tero, que es el que grita acá, pone acá, pone huevo?
¿Es de Tero?
Sí, sí. Ese es de Tero.
Pone huevo en un lugar y chilla en otro.
Chilla en otro.
Ajá. Porque sí tienen que ser muy protectores de la zona donde
viven.
Sí, o donde se asientan.
When I was a kid, I used to study birds.
Birds.
Yes, love birds, yeah.
My husband is a specialist, but he's not here.
Well, I'd look up all pictures of birds, like a field guide to the birds. Tried to spot them, but you're a kid, right? You can't really travel. So, you know, I only knew the ones in the neighborhood. I loved eagles.
But,
no. So it wasn't until I was like 25 or so before I saw my first eagle, and it was in a cage. You know? but I still love them. Birds of prey generally are really cool. So, but yeah, I draw pictures of them. Birds and flags.
I live in an area like 30 kilometers from here, and it's like we have a big garden. Normally in winter you don't vocalize birds. The thing is that one of these birds lay an egg in one part of the garden, so we couldn't get near. So we had a part of the garden that belonged to the bird. And if you dare to go, it would attack you.
Yeah.
It would attack you. We had to wait until the little city where the thing was born, the bird was born, and then like started making noise so that they would fly away.
Yeah.
But for like 3 months, that part of the garden belonged to them.
That's funny. Oh, really?
Can I take a photo?
Yeah, but still.
Mm-hmm. I believe that this is one of the biggest changes that maybe, not perhaps for the young people, but for us who have already been in teaching business for some time, I think that that is one of the biggest, threats to many.
Mm.
And on top of that, if you come to think, everybody has been trained, or you became a teacher, and you came out of a teacher training college, and you were trained that there was one right answer and the rest of the answers.
Oh my.
That's what we were just talking, no? Like, there was only one answer. And today, you have to, like, walk back and like, sort of grow in another truth.
Yeah. I think, and it's interesting you put that in the context of business, because business involves risk, and it involves financial risk, and people's livelihoods are at stake. So when you go wrong, you can go wrong badly and in a hurry. We've learned that. So I think that we have to understand risk as understanding that there are multiple possible futures, multiple possible outcomes. That what we believe is right may be wrong, and we need to plan for that. From a personal point of view, it's like always having a plan B. In a world of uncertainty, that's what you have to do. It's funny because we were talking about, I want to travel around Argentina, and people are saying, well, yeah, but you have to be careful about strikes. Yeah, okay, that's true. But, the way I look at something like that is, there isn't just one way to get from here to, say, Cordoba, right? Suppose I flew to Cordoba and there was a strike and I couldn't get back. Well, I can't think of myself as stranded. I have to think of myself as needing a different way back. And if I look at it in that way, well, I could take the bus. I could rent a car. If worst came to worst, I could take a taxi. It'd be expensive, but I could still do it, And so, there are different costs and different opportunities for each of those. Taking the bus back takes longer. It's cheaper, though, and you get to see the scenery. So, it's not all bad. And I was reading about buses, and you can even get, like, sleeper buses and things like that. So you save on the cost of a hotel room. So, it's this idea of just adapting to the different circumstances. And I could go on for a long time about, I won't, but about how economic theory and business theory has in the past behaved as though, in general, there is only one right answer to things, and even worse, that people, being rational consumers, will pursue that one right answer. And, the whole science of economics is predicated on this idea that people will pursue what's in their best interest. Observation shows that they won't. Even in cases where there's one right answer, a group of people will still find five answers and scatter off into the different directions. And if you don't plan for that, if you don't expect that the world will offer multiple answers rather than one answer, then that is the position of increased risk. So, it becomes a way of looking at the world. People my age grew up, I can say that now, I'm over 50. I never thought I could say it. I think it's a miracle I've made it to this age. But, grew up thinking that there was objective truth, that there was one way that the world is, that there is a best way to do things, and you even see that in the literature, like the whole literature of best practices. Think about the ontology that presupposes, right? That there are best practices, and But it turns out not to be the case. It turns out that, now, it's not simply that there is no right answer, there is no wrong answer, but the taxonomy of objective, right, wrong, best, that taxonomy is not descriptive of the world. If we get that taxonomy out of our life, then a lot of these questions become different kinds of questions, and they become questions about, you know, how do you mix things, how do you sort things, how do you combine things, how do you see things, and you know, even questions, practical questions about income, economics, business, they become different kinds of questions. You know, a business, instead of trying to succeed by amassing large quantities of money, learns to succeed by engaging and interacting in a business community. That's a different point of view. And then you do that and the money just comes because it flows through the whole community. And then you realize that a sole focus on making money is harmful to the enterprise of making money. Which sounds like a contradiction, but it's not a contradiction. It's, you know, and it's, again, you know, it's the words of Lao Tzu, the sole objective of obtaining power is contrary to the interest of obtaining power. A person who seeks power is least likely to get it, or at least to hold it. A person who seeks fame is least likely to get it, or at least to hold it. And then you understand that things like power and fame, etc., are accidental. That they're not things that you can plan for and program for, that they are what will happen on their own in the end. And so your approach to these things becomes very different. At least mine does.
Never.
I got it. Yeah, you can disagree with me. It's okay.
I mean, what you're saying is true. Like, you have to live with, and I like the idea of, like, living and having a plan B.
Mm-hmm.
Because for people our age, like, you grew up in a world where mm-hmm. things like, if you do A, and you do B, and then you do C, you will get B.
Yeah.
And it was, everything was like that. And
yeah.
All of a sudden, you wake up in a world where